two of the most potent forces for raising environmental consciousness in the last generation or so, my generation. I came of age with Dr. David Suzuki and Greenpeace. And, you know, the way they helped us understand the environment, the way they explained things simply and got right to the point, cut to the chase, it was really refreshing. So we'll get to Greenpeace in about half an hour or so with Rex Weiler. But right now, I'd like to introduce you to David Suzuki, whose latest book, Tree, is published by Greystone Books. And it's another example of that really simple and understandable explanation of a complex process. That is, following a tree over its 1,000-year lifespan, talking about the events, the organisms, the creatures that it affects that come in contact with it, and by way of explaining our world and the forest and all the rest of it. It's taking the individual and extrapolating to the general, and it's a really brilliant way to explain to us what's going on. And it's another example why David Suzuki has been so instrumental and influential over the last 25, 30 years. He's, of course, the host of the CBC TV's... I'm nervous, you know that? This guy's a star. I'm tongue-tied. Doesn't happen to me. He is the host of CBC Television's Nature of Things. He's the chair of the Dr. David Suzuki Foundation. He's a writer. He's a teacher. Oh yeah, and along the way, he's won a ton of awards, but I don't think that's as important as the work that he does and continues to do tirelessly. So please welcome the man who has been adopted by Hemptown Clothing, Dr. David Suzuki.
Thank you. Thank you. What Paul didn't tell you is I'm a big fan of Paul's. I'm an avid CBC radio guy, and I just bawled him out for not staying on the morning show as a host. This is my latest book. It's called Tree, A Life Story. The cover illustration was done by Robert Bateman, and inside are a whole series of line drawings that Bob did for the book that I think add tremendously. And I couldn't have done it myself. I've just been had too hectic a life to go through all the material I'd collected over several years now. So thank goodness Wayne Grady, a wonderful natural history writer, came on board and co-wrote the book with me, and I'm very, very pleased to talk about this. Now, some of you may immediately say, hey, wait a minute, you're a zoology guy, you're an animal guy, what the hell are you doing talking about plants? And that's, I think, a perfectly reasonable question, but in order to explain how someone like me, who really never paid much attention to plants because they're not cute and cuddly, they don't move, they don't make noise, why would I end up writing about a tree? So I'm going to spend most of the half hour I have trying to explain or give you a context within which you'll see why this life story is of interest. These days, I meet a lot of people in discussions I give, and the most common question I'm asked is, okay, what is the most urgent issue we face? Is it climate change? Is it species extinction? Is it overpopulation? Is it toxic pollution, deforestation, depletion of marine fishes? Which one is it? Well, the only honest answer is, I don't know. I mean, these are all, each one by themselves is a critical issue. But I don't know which one is going to take us beyond the threshold to the point of no return, where we can't reverse things. But I can tell you this, even if we resolve every one of these issues or problems, we won't have got much further because there will be new problems emerging. You see, the underlying root cause of all of the ecological issues we confront today is here. It's what lies inside our brains. It's what we look out and see in the world around. It's the values and belief systems inside our brain that lets us look at the world in a certain way and that motivates our actions. So if we don't come to grips with this thing here, we're going to have problem after problem after problem. A few years ago, I was fortunate enough to go to Peru with the ethnobotanist Wade Davis. And Wade took me to a valley where he has been going for the last 20 years. And he said, you know, David, you see that mountain there? The kids that grow up in this valley are taught that that
mountain is an apu, or a god. Not a symbol of God. They believe it is a god. And as long as you live within the shadow of that apu will determine your destiny. And I thought, wow, you grow up believing a mountain is a god. You're going to treat it in a very different way from a kid in Kimberley, BC, who's taught there's a lot of gold in that mountain. The way we look at the world determines the way we treat it. If you look at a forest as a sacred grove, rather than pulp or timber, if you look at a river as the veins of the land, rather than water for irrigation or power, if you look at the soil or as a complex community of organisms, rather than just dirt, or if you look at another species as a biological relative, rather than a resource, you see that we will treat those things very differently. So the important thing to remember is that what we believe and think determines the way that we will interact with the rest of the world. Scientists tell us that we as a species, Homo sapiens sapiens, evolved about 100,000 years ago somewhere in Africa. So I want you to try this thought exercise. Imagine 100,000 years ago, scientists in a galaxy somewhere else in the universe decide to look for life. They want to find out whether there's life anywhere else. And so they go roaring through the universe and they discover our solar system. And within our solar system, they see planet Earth and they realize there's life there. So imagine they park their rocket above the Rift Valley in Africa and they look down and what will they see? They will see plains filled with forests and plants, grasslands. They will see enormous herds of wildebeest and gazelles and zebras. They'll see elephants, giraffes and lions and rivers filled with crocodiles and hippos and flamingos. And just here and there, there'll be these tiny little groups of 5-6 naked apes standing on two legs, just emerging out of the web of life. Okay, and they would see us running around. Well, if I was a biologist coming to Earth looking down, I wouldn't even look at those things. I mean, they're not very big, there aren't many of them, they're not very strong, they're not very fast, and they're sure as hell not as pretty as a flamingo or a coho salmon. So, I mean, why would I bother with a critter like that? You know, I don't think any scientist would have said, watch that one, that is the creature of destiny, they're going to take over the planet. But if those scientists did notice those two-legged animals, and they began to watch them, they would see that they were behaving in a different way. And they would come to realize that from the outside, their survival skills are not very obvious. But there must be something inside their skulls, what we now know as the human brain, that gave them the leg up. You see, the human brain endowed us with an enormous capacity to remember things. Got a huge memory bank up here. We're very curious. We're very inventive. The French Nobel laureate François Jacob says that the human brain is unique in that it has a genetic inbuilt need for order. We don't like it when things happen around and we don't understand it. Chaos is frightening to us. So the human brain has this need to go and try to understand and create order in the world around. And very quickly, our ancestors, our distant ancestors, realized that there were cycles, there were patterns or regularities in nature. Day follows night follows day, the tides, the lunar cycle, animal migration through the seasons and so on. Humans recognized there were these repeating patterns. And we used those repetitions and predictability for our survival. And we created what anthropologists call a worldview. A worldview is the sum total of all of the observations, the intuitions, the speculations, the knowledge, all of the culture of a people. Is its worldview. And in a worldview, everything is connected to everything else. Nothing exists in isolation or separate. So if a hunter is out hunting and comes across an albino animal, or if a woman in the village gives birth to a two-headed child, people didn't just dismiss that as just a fluke or some random event. People looked at that and thought about it and said, are we being punished for something we did wrong? Or is this a sign that something extraordinary is going to happen in the future? Because in a worldview, everything is linked to everything else. And even today, if you go, and as I've been privileged to do, and spend time with traditional people or indigenous people around the world, and you listen to the stories they tell, they're all about telling themselves and people who they are and where they belong on the earth. Their stories, their songs, their prayers give thanks to the Creator for nature's generosity and abundance. They acknowledge that we are a part of nature and that we have responsibilities. And they promise that we'll behave the right way to keep the whole system going. That's the way it's always been. People understood that they were deeply embedded in the natural world and completely dependent on it. But today, in the last 100 years, dominant societies around the world have suddenly moved to cities. We live in a human-created environment where we think we're different from any other creature. We don't need nature. We're so smart, we create our own habitat, and it's the economy that delivers everything that we need. We see the entire planet now as not this magical place that's our home. We see it as our limitless resources to use as we want. We see all of the people on the earth as potential consumers to buy the products of our industry. And so we live now in a world that has been shattered into bits and pieces, and we no longer see the interconnectedness of everything. So, you know, when we go to shop in a Gap or a Roots or a Nike store, we want a product, right? You don't ever buy your product and think, gee, where this cotton and wool and rubber and leather and these products, where were they grown? What was the pay of the people that harvested them? What were the working conditions? We don't, you know, we just want a shirt. You just buy it, and we go and get an IBM computer or a TV, Sony TV or a GM car. We never think, gosh, there are dozens of metals in here. Where were they mined? What were the conditions of the mine? What were the ecological consequences? What were the labor conditions of the people that mined them for us? We just want a product. We buy it and use it. We live in a shattered world in which we no longer recognize that there are causal connections. If I do this, this could happen. If I don't do this, that might happen. People have always lived in a world of causality where they understood that what they did had consequences and therefore responsibilities. And the effect of that shattering of the world came through to me very, very clearly a few years ago when we did a program on the nature of things on asthma. Now, I grew up in the 1930s in Vancouver, and I can tell you, when I was a child, my parents had never heard the word asthma. It was a rare medical condition. Today, as you know, you can't go into any elementary school and not find all kinds of children with puffers. It's at epidemic levels. So I said, look, let's wait for a smog alert day in Toronto. You don't have to wait very long in Toronto for that. I was just there 2 days ago. There was a smog alert. And when the smog alert comes out, we'll send a crew down and film at the emergency ward at Toronto General. Smog alert came, sent the crew. Couldn't believe it. Jammed with old people and kids. Literally suffocating because they couldn't breathe. It was terrifying to me. And people would come roaring up to the emergency ward, rushing in their kids or their parents, just worried silly about the fate of their loved ones. But the amazing thing is that many of them drove up in a sports utility vehicle. And you realize there, they love their parents or their children. They would do anything to protect them from this life-threatening problem. But because they no longer see the world as an interconnected whole, they don't see that what they do is contributing to the crisis that they're dealing with. So as long as we live in a shattered world, how then are we going to be able to deal with these major issues? When we have so removed ourselves and no longer see that every action, you know, you go and shop in a Walmart store, you are making a decision that has huge ramifications. It's not just getting lots of stuff for cheap. You're making decisions about destroying the community you live in, or failing to support local merchants. What we do has repercussions. But as long as we live in a world in which we no longer see the connections, we don't feel that there's any responsibility, because we can't see where our actions affect the rest of the world.